Hello everyone, welcome along. It's good to be with you again on Planet FM and a very special guest today. Her name is Jeanette Turner Hospital. Some of you may remember, in fact Jeanette and I have been trying to work out, we think it was about 1992 that she came through for the Listener Women's Book Festival and I had the opportunity to interview her then. And I'm just wondering too, when I interviewed you back in 1992, were you living in the States by then? Because you're actually born in Australia.
That's right. I was living overseas. I was living in Canada then. It's only been 5 years since I've been living in the deep south in South Carolina.
I found that a very interesting place to go, South Carolina. Yeah. I mean, what is it like as an original Australian to live somewhere like the south?
5.5 years ago, I could not have imagined that as a possible future for myself. And it came completely out of the blue. I had this call. I was actually in France on a book tour. I was in Paris when the chair of the English department at South Carolina tracked me down through my publisher, took this phone call at a hotel in Paris, and was asked, do you know who James Dickey is? And I said, well, of course I know who James Dickey is. I'd seen Deliverance, that movie he wrote, and he was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. And also I'd read a series of articles in the New Yorker that summer written by his son, Christopher Dickey, about the filming of Deliverance. And I knew that he died recently. And I was asked, would I be interested in moving into his position at the University of South Carolina? And I said very politely, well, I don't think so. And in the back of my mind, I thought, the Deep South? You've got to be kidding. But if they were willing, if they wanted to fly me down to sort of check me out and let me check them out, I thought, why the heck not? I've never been to the Deep South. And it was not insignificant that I flew out of Toronto in a blizzard in January 99 and arrived in midwinter, January, South Carolina. And it was rather like midwinter in Brisbane or Sydney, you know.
Yes,
and I thought,
warmer.
I could live like this again. And actually, growing up in Queensland is very good practice for living in South Carolina in multiple ways.
Okay, let's talk about that. Climate, obviously.
Climate, yes. Yeah. Lush, tropical, subtropical growth. Politically backward and corrupt. You know, Joe Bjelke-Petersen ruled Queensland like his little personal feudal fiefdom for umpteen years, way too long.
Yes.
And the parallel in South Carolina even has a Scandinavian background with Strom Thurmond, who died just last year at the age of 100. He was already the senator for South Carolina, the senior senator for South Carolina, when I was in high school in Brisbane.
And he was
He's been senator time. From 1956 up until last year. And I'll tell you what I think is the funniest thing. My second year there, 2 years ago, when Strom had his 98th birthday, and he remained, by the way, an energetic and unreconstructed womanizer and bum patter right to the last.
There he is.
On his 98th birthday, and you've got, you know, one had to grudgingly admit the guy had spunk, he announced that he had decided that when his term of office expired in 2003, he had decided not to seek re-election. By this time, he's 98. Curious guy, because he was an arch segregationist. In 48, yes. He ran on the Dixiecrat ticket, segregation forever, more or less. But he was also a very practical politician who, once desegregation was a fait accompli, was the first person to have African-Americans on his senatorial staff. And basically, he just wanted to stay in power. And once the black vote was there, he was also actually very good for his black constituents. And so the funeral last year was
huge.
It was just absolutely huge. And even though people often disappear, he ran old-fashioned pork barrel politics, you know, which meant that just about everybody in South Carolina owed him for something. And he genuinely loved people in the old-fashioned politician way, you know. He loved sorting out your problems for you,
yes,
and
yes,
kissing your babies and
patting your bottom if you're a woman.
Right. So he was a very interesting person. But also South Carolina is Bible Belt, you know. It's
yes,
just full of Southern Baptists and snake handlers and Pentecostal. It's just weirdly interesting.
And you grew up.
I grew up in a fundamentalist family.
That's right.
So I know that turf, you know. So I have students who come from that background. And I extricated myself from it delicately because I didn't want to hurt my parents who are still very dear to me and are still inside that somewhat claustrophobic faith, and I'm not. But so it makes me both patient and probing with students from that background. Yeah. And when they learn that I came from that background and that I'm not going to mock it, but that I'm suggesting they reach beyond it, it works quite well. You know, they don't distrust me and get their backs up the way they do with Yankee intellectuals who come down
and try to tell them the way they should be living their lives. Mm-hmm. So you teach English literature, do you?
I teach literature courses as well as the graduate course seminars in creative writing. I'm the supervisor for the MFA in fiction, the Master of Fine Arts. So students who are doing a novel for their master's thesis, I supervise that. And I teach literature courses to postgrad and undergrad students as well.
And to think it all began for you in Melbourne, first of all, wasn't it?
I was born in Melbourne. I consider that a slightly embarrassing
Why is that?
I always find Melbourne, and I know it's a marvellous world city now, but I always find Melbourne rather smug, somewhat unwarrantedly smug. And I find the literary establishment in Melbourne a bit of a pain sometimes.
Yes.
And this also is why I like South Carolina. I really think of myself as a Queenslander. And, you know, Queenslanders are thought of by Sydney and Melbourne as the hick state,
yes, they
the boondocks.
Are, yes.
And so there's a certain feisty sense of oneself that you develop in Queensland over against that. And South Carolinians, so all Southerners have that over against
So it's an ideal
match,
really.
Yeah. It is, actually. Though, you know, when I was offered the position, I said to friends in Boston, where I had also lived for quite some time when I used to teach there, I said, don't you think it's weird that they would invite an Australian to replace James Dickey, this great Southern icon, you know? And my Yankee friends said, well, you know, the Southerners would far rather have an Australian than a Yankee.
Yeah, <that's laughs>
and
right.
It's true. You know, people had told me that they said, you know, you'll think that the Civil War ended 10 years ago. And I thought that was poetic exaggeration. Mm. Now that I'm there, I don't think the Civil War has ended, actually.
It still goes on.
A very, very intense emotional matter to Southerners.
Is your family grown up by now that you didn't have to bring them up in South Carolina?
Oh,
Had you already done all the mothering thing before?
I'm a grandmother of five.
Right.
None of them live in South Carolina. Our son and two grandsons, all my grandchildren are below from six downwards, you know. But two of the grandchildren are in Toronto. Our daughter lives in Atlanta, Georgia, which is the next state, so 3 hours away by car. We keep trying to get them to move to South Carolina so we can see our grandchildren every day, and we bribe them with being available to babysit, but
it hasn't quite worked yet.
It's not worked.
But you're obviously very firmly attached now to the American, as America, United States as a place to live.
Well, there was a, yes, I think that it's probable that I'll stay there because family is a bigger pull in place. For 20 years, I've come back every year, ranging from 1 to 4 months at a time, because my parents are still living in Brisbane and I have three brothers and nieces and nephews in Australia. It's you know, particularly for Mum and Dad, who are now very frail, and my mother has cancer. My parents are 90. So actually the last few years I've been coming back twice a year in order to just spend time with them.
How do they regard you? Because you broke away from from that religious fold that they had you beautifully cocooned in too, because, I mean, you don't look back on your background and wish you'd never been through it, because I guess it's made you the woman that you are today. Mm. But, I mean, then you went on to write all these novels and probably about things that,
embarrass them.
Yeah. So
how did you cope with that
and how did they cope?
It was much harder for them to cope. Mind you, I guess if I hadn't left home or left Queensland, I probably wouldn't have ever written written novels.
Yes.
It just would have been too inhibiting. And it's always been a bit tricky for me because I haven't wanted to hurt them. They're very dear to me, and they were very loving parents within a very, very restrictive worldview. I certainly had a very restricted childhood, or almost everything was forbidden, which is why I used to climb mango trees and read books, forbidden books. Yeah, it is hard for them. They've always been proud of me, and they've always hoped no one they know reads the books, I think.
Well, were you, I mean, where does the hospital come in? Is that your original
name? I married that.
You married a hospital, so you're, right. So you were a Turner first. So maybe
right.
People, when they see Turner Hospital, don't figure that you're one and the same person. So they might get away with, they don't go, there's that Turner girl, they're writing this disgusting, and it's not, of course, but, you know, to them, I guess it's a little bit far.
Well, I know all the family friends, of course, knew I married another Queenslander, Cliff Hospital, so it doesn't offer the family protection, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, when we come back, I want to talk about this latest book, because there's not enough time to go through all the wonderful books that you've written so far, but your latest book called Due Preparations for the Plague. I'm going to get you to read a little bit too, if you will, in a moment, but I thought you might like a little bit of Aretha Franklin, because I believe that you used to like Aretha Franklin back in your younger days.
Right, my hippie days.
Your hippie days.
60s in Harvard Square.
Indeed. Well, let's have a little bit of Aretha Franklin, then we're back talking to Jeanette Turner Hospital about her latest fascinating book called Due Preparations for the Plague.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired. And when I knew I had to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired.
There we go. Aretha Franklin, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. And it was actually quite fascinating watching Jeanette here, because it reminds you of those early hippie days, you were saying.
Some great parties in Harvard Square in the 60s, yeah.
So you were already, in those hippie days, you were already in the United States.
Right. We left Australia in 67 with no intention at all of staying away. My husband had a fellowship to do his PhD at Harvard, and so we lived there in Harvard Square for 4 years, when Harvard Square was at its heyday, I'd say.
Yes.
You know, it was very politicized, and it was a great time.
You even went to India for about
twice, on my husband's sabbaticals. Right.
And lived in an Indian village?
Right.
What were you doing there?
Well, it was his research. He's a Sanskrit scholar and
sort
of historian of comparative religion. So he was doing comparison of Hinduism and Christianity and Judaism and Buddhism.
And what was that like? I mean, did you have family with you as well?
Yes, we had, the children were 10 and 8 that first time we were in India. And my first novel is set there,
That's
The Ivory
right.
Swing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it was basically where perhaps it all started to happen for you in terms of
it was
realizing that you weren't just an academic or anything like that. You were someone who wanted to write.
It is where it happened, but it didn't happen in the sense of I realized it. It happened out of a dearth of options. You know, I'd been a high school teacher in Australia, and then I became a librarian at Harvard, and then we moved again to Canada, and I did my graduate work in medieval literature, and then we went off to India, and, you know, I wrote a short story in India, which I sent back, and it won an award and was published in the Atlantic Monthly. And they said to me, you know, this is really interesting stuff, this West-East culture clash. Why don't you expand it into a novel? And by that time, I was so dislocated, and I had so many truncated careers that writing is a way of using up the leftovers, as it were. So I wrote a book.
And, of course, it all started from there. How many novels have you written now, including due preparations
That's
for the play?
That's the seventh.
The seventh.
Seventh novel.
And you've written short
Three
stories.
Three collections of short stories, yeah.
So is it... Like, do you aim to complete a novel once a year or once every
2 years?
Oh, no,
my gosh, no. I mean, novels take me 3 to 4 years,
right.
this one. And that's the thing. Due preparations for the plague had been 3 years in the writing when 9/11 happened. So although it's about terrorism and the CIA and a hijacking, that it was a horrible fluke that it became so immensely topical. I was actually... on the last 20, 30 pages of the novel when 9/11 happened.
And where were you on that day?
I was in South Carolina.
Right.
And have students who were from New York. And the whole university, once we realized what was happening, just came to a standstill and people just clustered around television sets. And we had students who were frantic because all the phone lines were down and cell phones weren't working either because the transmitter towers were down. So there were students just prostrate with anxiety because they didn't know if their families were okay or not. So it felt very close to the bone,
yes,
very visceral.
Too. So this book, as you say, it had been in preparation for a while. Mm-hmm. Give us a quick little synopsis, if I may be so bold as to ask you to do this, about this fantastic book, about what it's about.
It's about a hijacking, a fictional hijacking, that I based on two actual hijackings, the Lockerbie bombing of December 88 and the Entebbe hijacking much earlier in 76. In my fictional hijacking happens in September 1987. And when the novel opens, 13 years later, two people who were intensely connected to that hijacking are, one is Samantha, who was a child of six on the flight. And through negotiations with the terrorists, the children were all offloaded, and then the plane was blown up. And so these children saw on television their parents blown up.
Their parents being blown up.
So they're, of course, traumatized by this badly. The other main character is Lowell, who was 16 years old at the time of the hijacking. He was not on the plane, but his mother was. So he, too, every anniversary of the hijacking has a very rough time. Mm-hmm. He's very disturbed. And it's made more complicated for him by the fact that his father is in intelligence, is an agent with the CIA, and he knows that. He's never really known what his father does because intelligence agents can't talk
to
anybody
about
it. And nor does he want to know, but it turns out that his father, who had the code name of Salamander, was rather heavily implicated in that hijacking, which was meant as a sting operation to catch and expose a terrorist cell, but it went horribly wrong.
Yeah.
So those three people, Salamander unravels with remorse at the unintended consequences of this act. And it's really a theme that has always been close to the bone for me, is how people manage the rest of their lives in the wake of really terrible events. And Samantha and Lowell represent the two extremes of the way people handle this. Samantha... It becomes obsessed with every detail, uncovering every shred of information that she can about it and wanting to find out who was accountable and hold them accountable. And that tends to be the way women react to grief and tragedy.
Right.
And Lowell takes the typical male route, which is complete repression, block out everything that reminds you of this incident. And neither way is particularly healthy or good for a functional life. And in a way, Samantha's bugging Lowell, because that's what she does. She's obsessive about making contact with everyone. And his resisting her, they actually push each other toward health. And the novel ends in August 2001, only 3 weeks and one block away from 9/11. And that was originally my fictional hijacking was in 88.
Yeah.
After 9/11 happened, I didn't want the present to contain that act. I wanted the present to be just before that happened.
Yeah.
But it's a profoundly ironic ending, because it's sort of Samantha and Lowell have reached this point of temporary and fragile peace and happiness with the past, but the reader knows that in 3 weeks' time and one block away from they are, this
something
dreadful thing is
going
to happen.
You've got a little section for us, just while we've got time, from your book. Would you care to read a little bit for us? That would be
great. This is Samantha, now a young woman of 19, trying to piece together the past. Look at Samantha. Here she is, the day the world changed, on the border between before and after, in fading color on Kodak paper. She's 6 years old. She's wearing a blue woolen coat and a cotton dress. And she's also wearing white lace-edged socks and black patent leather shoes. The sign above her head says Porte 12, because this envelope was taken at Charles de Gaulle Airport in September 1987. Framed by the doorway to the boarding tunnel, she's turning back to wave. Her left hand clutches the hand of a young man. The man is her father. A one-armed teddy bear, once Samantha's, but given to her baby brother just weeks earlier, dangles from her right hand. And when she waves, the teddy bear swoops about like a flag. She's laughing, and there is a dimple just to one side of her mouth. Her father is also laughing and waving. Beside him, a woman, perhaps weary, her smile slightly tense, holds baby Matthew up to the view of those who have come to see the family off. Your mother made your coat, Samantha's aunt tells her. She did? She made all your clothes. She was that kind of mother. That kind of mother. Samantha saves this phrase. She saves every fragment, every splinter of information. I still have the dress, she says. Sometimes at night, when Samantha cannot sleep, she takes the dress out of its tissue paper and holds it against her cheek. But it keeps its secrets. It's torn, she tells her aunt. There's a rip in the skirt, but it's not torn in the photograph. It must have caught on something when they put us on the escape hatch. I can't remember tearing it. We couldn't get that coat off you. You even wanted to sleep in it, her aunt says. I must have taken it off, though. Eventually, my mother must have talked me into it. It must have been in the overhead locker. Samantha thinks she can remember her father putting the coat there. Sometimes she can remember. It all depends on which way she tells the story to herself. Perhaps it was during the first landing, she says. That was Morocco, her aunt says. The TV camera would zoom in close, and I would watch carefully, hoping to see your face through the window. It was very hot, Samantha says. She undoes several buttons at the neck of her cotton dress. People were fainting from the heat, I remember that. And she thinks she remembers her mother saying, heat prostration, and Sam, if you don't take off your coat. And she took it off then, she thinks. And maybe her father put it up in the overhead locker, or maybe Sam kicked it under the seat. Wherever it was, the coat remained on the plane. It did not slide down the escape hatch with Sam. More than 13 years later, the lost coat still gnaws at her days and her nights. It has eaten her. In dreams, she looks under the seat, and she opens the overhead locker, but her coat is gone, and a salamander with slug-like skin and a smell of blocked drain pipe slithers out. Its eyes are bloodshot. How much do you know? Its eyes ask. I know more than you think, Samantha tells the bloodshot eyes, and what I don't know yet, I'll find out.
Oh, beautiful, and beautifully timed too. That is fantastic. And of course that's just part of a wonderful, wonderful novel. I mean, we've only got 50 seconds left, but you even, to get into the writing of it, you put on the protective clothing that people mm-hmm. wear when there's chemical gas and everything I like did. That, and you lasted 5 seconds
in
there.
Oh, it's horrible. Well, 5 minutes, but it is very, very awful.
Well, I would have lasted 5 seconds. I believe it's claustrophobic.
It is very claustrophobic, and a lot of horrible things happen to your body once you're encased in a gas mask and protective suit.
Well, the book is superb, and I thank you so much for joining me today. It's been lovely to catch up with you 14 years down the road, and I hope that we'll catch up again in the not too distant future. Thank you so much.
My pleasure to be here, and I hope I don't have to wait 14 years to come back.
Exactly. Jeanette Turner Hospital, and the book is called Due Preparations for the Plague. It's available in all good bookshops. It's by HarperCollins. Do get hold of it. It's only $24.99. It's an excellent price, and in the light of 9/11, you are going to love this book. It is so well written. It's a fantastic read. Thanks for your time, everyone. Catch you soon.